The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be featuring an interview with Mendel Kalmanson, who's a Chabad rabbi in England, who's written a book, A Time to Heal, Mourning and Other Things Such as That. Mourning, not like as in good morning, but M-O-U-R-N-I-G. The portion of the week is the portion of Toldos, can be found in Genesis 29. We have lots of wonderful music for you, as we just sampled just 15 seconds of in our opener. A dynamic, awesome Hasidic story way at the end of the hour, which is going to come really soon. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Security forces in Israel have been on guard all this week. Dozens of terrorists were arrested for attempted attacks. Police are actually now more concerned about angry mobs of Israelis who attack terrorists who are making a terrorist attack. They beat them up and other type things. A Palestinian from Gaza was arrested for misdirecting building materials to be used for civilian purposes to Hamas, which used them for terrorist purposes. The materials were approved for import to Gaza by the UN Oversight Committee, but never reached their destination. 2 weeks after it was burned down and desecrated by Arab rioters, Joseph's tomb in Shechem was repaired in an overnight operation. The five-hour repair job that normally would have taken a week was conducted by rabbis, IDF officers, and over 50 contractors, all volunteers. Another dust storm is raging through Israel. It's after the one that happened last August. Eastern winds of up to 40 miles an hour fill the skies with dust, making the air unbreathable, especially in the south. Eilat Airport remained closed. Air quality in Jerusalem is listed as poor. Three Jews, including a rabbi, were attacked on their way to a synagogue in Marseille, France. A woman in her 50s was seriously injured after being stabbed twice in the stomach. A Jewish man was stabbed in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, in New York, and remains in serious condition. Police sources say a black man stabbed the off-duty medic from behind with an unknown weapon and fled. And finally, 3,500 emissaries are taking part in the annual Global Conference of Chabad Rabbis. Chabad statistics list 4,325 Chabad shluchim worldwide in 86 countries. New countries added this year are Angola, Ghana, the Virgin Islands, and Jamaica. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Rabbi Mendel Kalmanson from London, England, who's written a book called A Time to Heal, dealing with mourning and tragedy. How are you today, Mendel?
Thank God. Baruch Hashem.
Good to hear. Let's talk generalities at first before we actually talk about some parts of the book. It's human, it's normal for people to feel grief after a loss. And Judaism has a lot to say about it, both as far as Jewish law, things that have to be done, and the philosophy about it, the why. I would like to focus more on the why. There's an exact prescription which is set out by Jewish law. What's the philosophy behind mourning in a procedural way?
That's a great question. I think to tackle the question, let's first zoom out for a moment and discuss a bit of a paradox inherent to the Jewish perspective on mourning. Point one is, of course, that from the spiritual Jewish teachings, we learn that our life is comprised of multiple dimensions and aspects. Of course, the physical, mundane, but also the spiritual soul, so to speak. And it's the soul that lives eternally. It predates and outlives our physical stay on earth. And that soul is encompassed and contained in a body for a short stay here on earth to achieve an earthly mission. And then when it passes on, it returns to a more spiritual dimension of existence. And so if you approach it strictly from that theoretical spiritual plane, the reality is that when a soul returns to its maker, it actually experiences a certain sense of liberation and bliss because it's no longer hindered or, if you will, according to some mystical terminology, trapped in the earthly trappings and existence. So if you look at it from that point of view, the passing of the soul back to its original pristine, innocent spiritual state is cause for celebration, is cause for joy. And in fact, the soul itself does experience joy and ascent and bliss. So on the one hand, counterintuitively, the experience we look at and view with the greatest trepidation and fear and anxiety, namely death, is in fact something that the soul looks forward to on some level because it allows it to return back to its spiritual abode where it feels natural and organically linked to spiritual energy and existence. And from that point of view, one might even wonder why at all are we, is there an allowance or even religious prescription, as you touched on earlier, to the mourning process, which might, it would seem, suggest that there's something negative and there's something, of course, painful about the process that we need to address. And that's where we find this, we encounter this paradox, because as elevating and liberating as the experience might be from the soul's point of view, the reality is such that it's spent quite a substantial period of time in this world interacting with physical beings, with its loved ones, creating memories and emotional attachments and so forth. And so for the people it leaves behind, there is, of course, a huge vacuum and void that is felt tangibly and very painfully. And it is that the Torah addresses in its prescription for mourning. And that, I think, in a nutshell, encompasses the paradox of Judaism itself. It, of course, believes in the essential spiritual content and nature of reality, but always takes into account the physical shell, if you will, the physical component to life. And in this instance, it, of course, addresses the very real grief that the loved ones of someone who passes on feel and experience because they no longer have that opportunity to interact with their loved one in the physical. And so you find this gradual process and progress of mourning made, where the first day Jewish law prescribes very strict regulation and law pertaining to mourning, and that eases up on the third day and eases up even more so after the seventh day, and then, of course, 30 days later, there's yet another milestone. And so over the course of the first year, there is a certain moving away from that original initial allowance for grief because over time, the Torah encourages us to elevate ourselves to the viewpoint where we encounter the essential truth of reality, and that is that our loved one continues to exist and, in fact, flourishes on a different dimension posthumously.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, our guest today is Mendel Commerson. He's written a book, Time to Heal, dealing with mourning and grief. So why can't people just roll their own, as the question goes, is make up their own thing? I want to mourn in my way. I don't want to have it dictated. I'll give you for examples. Somebody with whom I learned, mother just passed away at age 98. And the way he put it is she should have died 10 years ago. She was blind and deaf and senile. And then he said, and I didn't like her anyway. She was a terrible mother. You know, so it's, and I have to go through this and I have to say Kaddish for 12 months now, 11 months now. So, and he didn't feel like a loss. He felt relief. But there, we're still told that a person has to go through the prescription. Could you please then elucidate that, Rabbi Collinson?
Well, that's a very good question. There are two dimensions to the process of mourning. We touched on earlier the process is there to help the bereaved experience a certain comfort, as it were. But, of course, there's another aspect to the process of mourning, which is there to help ease the transition of the soul itself from its limited physical stay on Earth into the next life and into the next dimension of existence. And that is something that, regardless of what the bereaved is feeling, benefits and influences the soul who departed, and it's in tribute and in gratitude, really, to the person who passed, especially a parent who gave one their very existence, their life itself, that some of that prescription addresses. So, for example, a very interesting theme that the Rebbe talks about, it's a very moving point if you think about it, is that essentially souls are referred to in Kabbalistic literature in the Jewish mystical esoteric tradition before and after their physical lifetime as stationary to some extent. And during their stay here on Earth, they are referred to in some texts as, if you will, dynamic. And the idea that's really trying to convey is that the very reason a soul leaves its pristine spiritual state and enters the physical world, which of course is not intuitively, if you will, welcoming to or transparent to the divine within all, is in order to have an impact on this physical world and to bring about a bit more of the transparency between the source of all and the expression of all. And that unique achievement, that unique objective, can only be fulfilled here in this physical state of existence. For example, when somebody eats something and they take that energy and they reflect on or contextualize that energy and use it for a higher purpose, to be more patient, to be more tolerant, to give them discipline, to be kinder, and so forth. They've taken physical energy and they've elevated it into a spiritual form of consciousness that has informed their higher behavior and higher self. That can only be done here on Earth. That's a unique and fleeting and finite opportunity that the soul experiences during its physical stay. Once it passes, it no longer has that ability to impact the physical universe. And it is then that, as the Rebbe puts it, the souls it leaves behind, especially its children and loved ones, they now become its quote-unquote arms and legs in the physical world to continue to impact this world, linking their actions to the memory of the soul that departed. And in that way, the soul that departed continues to have physical influence on this world. In other words, once a soul passes on, it's called stationary because it cannot any longer continue to impact the physical world in and of itself because it no longer has that physical vessel and counterpart called the physical body, personality, and so forth, which allows it to interface with the universe. But the souls it leaves behind, if they link their actions and their good thoughts and their good deeds and their good words to the memory of the soul that departed, they are actually allowing that soul in its stationary state to continue to be dynamic. So here you find a fascinating idea where the physical, where the children of someone who passed can not only still connect, but they can influence the spiritual ascent and elevation of a soul that passes. And that's why when we refer to the annual, marking of a passing of somebody, we use the word aliyat neshama, which means the ascent of the soul. It's not about commemorating a soul that once lived in this world. It's actually about generating movement, ascent, and spiritual elevation in that soul. And that can only take place if we continue to impact this world for the better, again, linking it to the souls that passed. So going back to your question, that was a bit of amusing, but coming back to the question of, well, if somebody doesn't feel pain in the departure of a parent, Judaism nevertheless prescribes a certain formula, in a certain sense, to give back to the soul that gave to them their very life.
Okay, very good. That's fascinating. If you're just joining us again, we're talking with Mendel Kalmanson. He's a rabbi from London, England, and written a book called A Time to Heal. Heal means a person's sick. Is a person who is suffering grief sick, Rabbi Kalmanson?
Well, that's a tough question. You can heal in many different ways. I want to move away from the word sick, because sick implies, you know, some type of illness or condition. I think we can all do with healing. I think healing means to come back to ourselves, right? When we experience pain and suffering, you know, we're not comfortable. We're not comfortable in our existence. There's a certain angst that is introduced into our lives, a certain unsettling sensation. So healing means to come back to our core, come back to our to ourself. And that, in that respect, I think there is no question that grief, that loss, that bereavement, deeply unsettles a person's, or derails even a person's life. And in that sense, I think, yes, of course, healing is essential, because ultimately, in so many people's personal lives, a period of grief or a period of loss can really, really paralyze them, sometimes even define or confine them to a particular condition, to a particular pattern of thought or behavior, and it can change their life one way or another. And so healing means to bring them back to their core and to take the negative energy they've absorbed and that builds up inside of them and to release it and channel it into something positive and constructive, which, by the way, is another very essential theme of the Rebbe's talks. Essentially, the Jewish response to suffering, and of course, as a people, we are unlike any other in terms of our history of persecution. Nevertheless, we have always been taught not to ask, why me, but to ask, what now? That is to say, not to wallow in our misery, in our bitterness, and to become a recluse or withdraw or recoil from day-to-day life, which of course, by definition, includes all sorts of experiences, but to re-engage, re-immerse in life and take that energy that builds up and instead of hold it in and allow it to fester, which is, of course, poison to the soul, harness it, channel it, and then create something positive from that. And this runs through all of Jewish history as a whole, but especially the Rebbe, you find something fascinating. The Rebbe experienced quite a few instances of personal loss in his life, and what's fascinating to note, perhaps we can explore this on a different occasion in greater detail, is after every single moment of loss in his life, the Rebbe created from that loss an institution, a campaign, a cause. So just a few brief examples. After the loss of his mother, with whom he was incredibly close, he had spent 22 years apart from her as a result of World War II, in fact, they say when he reunited with her, they hugged for 20 minutes or so. They were so close. In fact, every day of his life after they reunited, he would make it a point of personally visiting her despite his enormous responsibilities and very, very hectic schedule. Of course, Rebbe was running world organization and did so in order to spend a few minutes with his mother. They were extremely close. And you find that after her passing, the Rebbe began a whole new methodology to a particular teaching that he introduced, which is basically the studies on Rashi. Rashi, the famous biblical commentator, is of course known to all. But the Rebbe took his teachings, his insights, and created a methodology to it. He created principles and guiding axioms to how it is Rashi determines which commentary he uses on whatever verse he is commentating on. And so you see the Rebbe took that, he dedicated it to his mother, took that energy and channeled it intellectually. Then you find with the loss of his own wife, with whom he was incredibly close, And there are so many beautiful anecdotes that demonstrate their closeness. Remember as well that they didn't have children, which we can only speculate brought them even closer in a sense. The Rebbetzin was, by all accounts, the Rebbe's partner, the Rebbe's support. They were very, very close. And after her passing, of all things, the Rebbe started a birthday campaign, taking a scenario which emphasizes perhaps the loss or absence of life and replacing it with a campaign, inviting the entire Jewish community to celebrate the presence of life. And I find that fascinating. And the same was when he lost, with the loss of his father, he started organizations, campaigns for the elderly, called Tiferet Levi Yitzchak, and so forth. So the idea is that the things that happen in life create in us or around us energy. And what we do with that energy ultimately is really how Judaism defines the proper response to those things that we encounter in life.
Okay. Would you, Rabbi Kalmanson, counsel someone who has suffered a loss to start some sort of a campaign to direct their energies?
No doubt. Obviously, remember that, as mentioned earlier, there is a time and there's a place for everything. In fact, the reason I call the book A Time for Healing is based on the beautiful text from, the beautiful text we find at the very beginning. It's actually...
Of Proverbs, actually, yes.
Exactly, quoted in the beginning of the book, which talks about a time for everything. And so immediately, initially after loss, I think the philosophy behind Jewish principle of Shiva and Shloshim, which is the seven-day period and then the 30-day period, and even the first year period, all of that, I think, demonstrates that initially there is a time for grief. There must be an allowance for a person to really, even if you will, embrace the pain, embrace their grief, rather than bottle it up and ignore it. I've spoken to so many people in my community and beyond who said that they've come to appreciate the profound understanding Judaism has for the human condition, especially precisely when they went through loss, because they said, you know, being confined, as it were, to one's home for a week with their siblings and immediate family forces them to really encounter full-on the life that they just, so to speak, lost, and they reminisce and they draw closer and essentially becomes a week. According to one of my community members, It was one of the highest weeks he's ever lived, rather than one of the lowest weeks. Imagine that. And that's because they allow themselves to really engage with their pain. And in so doing, they really tackled it head on. And I think this is a general point. A lot of the unhealthiness, in the human condition has to do with the buildup of negative energy, which can be toxic. So here Judaism teaches us you have to embrace it, you have to deal with it, you have to, you can't ignore it and push it away and say, you know what, I'm tougher than that, or, let me move on. No, so I think initially it's a very important emphasis on really, really allowing the pain to find expression. It's only in phase two, as I would put it, that now the question is, now what do I do? And that's, I think, where we talk about building constructively. In the book, there's actually a chapter about a horrific terror attack that took place in Kfar Chabad, where five students in a vocational school were brutally cut down by, Palestinian terrorists. And it's fascinating to note that the Rebbe did not immediately respond. He actually took a few days to respond, and only after a few days did he respond and say, "Behemshech habinyan tenachemu," which is Hebrew for "through the continued building of your community will you be comforted." And I think it's very important because there are two lessons there. Lesson one is that when someone's undergoing the pain of grief, you have to be there for them. It's not a time for words. It's definitely not a time to talk about channeling that energy at all. It's a time to literally be there for them. But then after that period passes, and that's a very, very individual thing to do with every single, personal case. Some people, they're ready to move on quicker. Some take longer. It depends also on the connection to the personal past. But at some point, we go into phase two where we say, well, now what? How can I take that negative and turn it into a positive? And that's, I think, where definitely, by all means, I would suggest to anyone going through or having gone through a loss to somehow try to take that energy and channel it and build something constructive in the memory of the person's past. And in so doing, we come full circle to the point we mentioned earlier. We don't just commemorate the soul that passed. We actually contribute and influence its spiritual ascent.
Okay. Rabbi Carlson, let's segue that thought into the communal or collective mourning that Jews display. Once a year, we have Tisha B'Av commemorating various disasters that have befallen the Jewish people. We have Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Memorial Day. We have, and people are dealing now what's going on in Israel with terrorism and whatnot. So does this line of reasoning then apply? Can we carry it through to collective mourning and collective grief?
That's a great question. Absolutely. Let me highlight one anecdote that I think captures the Rebbe's response to the collective calamities that befell the Jewish people. And in recent history, no greater and more horrific calamity than the Holocaust itself. I forget what year it was, but at some point, as I recall, the UJA, the United Jewish Appeal, a very, very prominent Jewish organization, came to see the Rebbe, and they had a unique suggestion. An initiative they were trying to implement across the Jewish community around the world in order to commemorate the Holocaust and the 6 million souls that were lost. And they came to see the Rebbe because essentially they wanted his support, because by extension, of course, through his disciples and sympathizers, they hoped to enlist hundreds of thousands, if not more, Jewish people in this initiative. And what they were trying to do is that Passover, they asked every Jewish household to bring an empty chair to the Passover dinner, to the Seder, to emphasize the loss and the void created by the Holocaust. And in so doing, this would be a very tangible way of keeping the memory of those who were lost, those who perished, in the hearts, minds, and consciousness of the Jewish community. And the Rebbe's response is astounding. It's really profound, I believe, and really embodies and encapsulates his entire philosophy when it came to commemorating days of mourning, both collectively and individually. His response was that while, of course, the intention is wonderful and it's an important initiative, I would make one suggestion, one change, Rebbe said. Instead of taking an empty chair and bringing it to the table, what I would suggest is go out there and find a Jew who would not otherwise attend the Passover Seder and invite them to the Passover dinner and let them occupy that chair that would otherwise be void. And this is incredibly profound because it creates a paradigm shift. It says, take that extraordinary void and vacuum created by the Holocaust and fill it. What does it do to us? It shouldn't make us emphasize that loss, but instead we should take that loss and turn it into gain. We should take that vacuum and fill it with goodness and kindness. We should take the physical loss and turn it into a spiritual gain, so to speak. And the Rebbe said this in many instances to so many different people. Especially, there was a few times people addressed Holocaust Memorial. And in one instance, there was a town or a village in Poland, I believe, called Glubaco. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And their descendants decided to create a fundraising campaign in order to build a museum which highlighted the Jews of their town that were sadly killed by the Nazis. And the Rebbe said, you know, it's a wonderful effort. It really is. But what I would suggest is actually building an educational institution where the descendants of those people who perished in Glubaco are educated Jewishly instead of spending all that money teaching them how their ancestors died. Why don't you spend all that money teaching them how Jews are meant to live? And this really goes back, there's really a running theme in the interview, because it goes back to that idea of, you know, what would the soul want from you? If you could, so to speak, interview a departed soul and ask it, what would you want of us, those who are still alive? The Rebbe felt deeply that the soul would definitely encourage its descendants to continue to live the life it wanted to live, it stood for, it represented, rather than to, as well-intentioned as it may be, simply create a space that emphasizes the loss and the void created by a particular negative occurrence in Jewish history. So I believe that it's something that really could have great resonance in the Jewish community. And, it applies to the individual and the collective equally.
This has been fascinating, Mendelkamm. I want to thank you so much for coming on again. The book is called A Time to Heal, Insights into the Lubavitcher Rebbe on Grief and Mourning. And we wish you continued success.
Thank you very much. Can I add one final footnote?
Please.
You know, many people have speculated about the tremendous focus that the Lubavitcher Rebbe placed on the end of days, or what we call in Hebrew Mashiach, or the Messianic era, when according to Jewish thought and philosophy and belief, the world will experience a shift of consciousness. There will no longer be any war, any hate, any hunger, any poverty, and so forth, but everyone will be engaged in the pursuit of godliness, as it were. And what motivated that tremendous enthusiasm and passion and hyper-focus, even borderline obsession, if you will, on the topic of Mashiach, literally from when he assumed the mantle of leadership throughout the four decades of his leadership. And I believe that, as the Rebbe himself said in numerous instances, that was the ultimate channeling of the, if you will, negative energy of Jewish history into the final end game of this entire story called human existence. The Rebbe believes deeply that we're actually, as difficult as it may seem, or as difficult as it may appear, especially with what's going on in the Holy Land with our brothers and sisters in Eretz Israel, sometimes it seems like history is actually regressing rather than progressing. But the Rebbe believed adamantly that we're experiencing a forward march of history, and all of our past really is not divorced from or independent from our present, and definitely not our future. And the way to channel all of that grief, all that pain, and our history, which is full of difficult moments, is to take all of that and turn it into a constructive force for good, but in terms of prayer, in terms of the ultimate desire that the Jewish people should experience as a collective, it should be to bring about that final period of time when we will usher in stability, we will usher in love, brotherhood, and, of course, peace and prosperity to all. Please, may it be speedily in our days.
Amen. That would be wonderful. Okay, thank you so much, Mendel Collinson, and we wish you good luck in all of your endeavors.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Show.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, The Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. I found that to be quite settling, and I feel good after talking to Rabbi Kalmanson. It's a good perspective on life and how to deal with things. Up next is, this is brand new, this is just a few days old, this song. The composer is Mendy Weinstein. It's called Tonight We Go.
Mm-hmm. long, so far away. Felt like we made a big mistake. Pages turning, calendar ends, a new year. Stick our feet in the mud, heads turn, a new fear. And as the sound of the dead slowly fade, we make our way to a self-dug grave. Inspiration trying, belief dying. So all we can do is pray. Tonight we go. Sound of light, a nation hears what is normally bright. Generations begin to arise. Yeah, set sun shining, heal the wounds. Yeah, people smiling, you reveal the truth. The war is over, peace now rules. Set the war is over, peace now rules.
A better place to run the race, we set the pace. The clouds are dropping, there is no stopping. This full redemption, a true connection. No misconception, it's full perfection. No longer deprived, Mashiach has arrived. The true essence, Hashem's real presence. Heaven on earth, rebirth.
And if you can't believe, then open your eyes and see. Tonight we go.
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Fidman here. The time is fleeting by. This is the Melody Klezmer Trio. It's a new group. Obviously, it's a trio. It's three people, yes. This is called simply Yiddish Melody, and it's a composition of Yiddish standards. Let's listen.
Thank you.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Hey, Shulman Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. This week's portion is the portion of Toldos. It can be found in Genesis chapter 29 and further. Discusses the birth of the twins Jacob and Esav. The blessing that was redirected from Jacob, from Esav to Jacob. In the middle of this whole account, there is a story whence there was a drought. This is commonplace in Israel. We talk about it. If you listen to the Jewish Hour for any length of time, you know that there's droughts all the time in Israel. These last 2 years have been bumper crop for rain. That's not really right, but that's not the right adjective. But there's been a lot of rain, but there's been time when it's gone 5 years without raining a drop in Israel. And it doesn't rain in Israel. People don't eat. It gets really scary. Isaac was told, don't go down to Egypt because you've been dedicated as a sacrifice in last week's portion when he was put on the altar. And an animal that has been dedicated for a sacrifice is not allowed to live Israel. So he was told to go to Grar, which Grar essentially is Gaza, which is technically speaking a part of Israel. And there's this whole interaction between Abimelech, the king of Gerar, and Isaac and his family, and how the whole thing develops. There's a very interesting part at the end of all this, where they have a fight, and Abimelech says, "Listen, you go your way. I'm going to stay here. It's time. You have to leave. It's not working with you being around here." And there's a whole series of wells that get stuffed and redug. And finally, the two, Isaac and Abimelech, make a pact. And the pact is made in Beersheba. Last week, there was a pact made between Avraham and same king, Abimelech, in Beersheba, same place. There it says that the reason why Beersheba is called Beersheba, Ber means a well. Sheva has one of many connotations. Sheva could mean an oath, which is what was done there. There was an oath taken between Abimelech and Avraham. Here, the pact, there's a whole bunch of wells. This was the seventh well that was dug, and the word Sheva means seven. And so it was said, even though there was competition for other wells that Isaac had dug, because water was at such a premium, they agreed that Beersheba belonged to the Jews, unequivocally. So here again, we see yet another example of historical evidence of Israel belonging to the Jews, historically. We're talking 4,000 years of Beersheba being a Jewish city. If anybody lays claim to Beersheba, all we need to do is show him chapter 31 in the book of Genesis. Look, it's right here, black and white. This book is 3,300 years old, telling about an incident that happened 700 years before that. Israel belongs to the Jews unequivocally. Again, we said this last week in the same vein. Well, the Bible's teaching is not a history. This is not sociology, not demographics. Okay, we have historical proof. But the Bible is a personal lesson book towards us, to us, each and every individual. This, that we've made a pact with so and such, which in this case, Avimelech would be considered an analogy for our own physical body and the physical world around us, which is claiming anything good that we do really should fall into the possession and category of the mundane, if not the profane, but we're not going to talk about profane. Mundane, bad enough. So what we do is we make a pact with the mundane. We will utilize the mundane and turn it into a Be'er Sheva, turn it into a well, a source of life, based on an oath, a promise to be dedicated to the Almighty, such that even the mundane can now be elevated to the holiness, to the level of holy. That's what the allusion to in this interchange is, that yes, we live in a world, and it's a drought out there. The Torah is compared to water. There's no Torah out there. There's no life out there. It's all death. That's what's out there. What are we doing? What do they do with the water? It says that Isaac took the water, and in a field that normally grew one measure, in Isaac's field it grew 100 measures. And so that we can take the mundane and cause it to flourish, to make the world absolutely a better place, to finally realize the final redemption with the Messiah's coming. Speaking of final, we've got to take our final commercial break and be right back. We've got an awesome Hasidic story just waiting for you. Don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. We want to send out a shout-out to Mrs. Specs Howard, Tzivia Bas Saragolda, who had a procedure this week, which was monumental, life-saving procedure. It was a quick in-and-out procedure done at the hospital. And she's happy, healthy, and should live to 120 and beyond. We wish them all the best at Specs Howard, a proud sponsor of the Jewish Hours. Hour since our inception. They're at this point the only original sponsor that we had 19 years ago. We love Specs Howard because Specs Howard loves us. Want to get in touch with me? Best way, rabbifinman.com, RABBIFINMAN.com. You'll find archived editions of the show. You'll find various missives that I write are posted to the webpage. There's classes that I teach, and the very, very, very important donations page. Yes, you know about it. If you listen, this is a time where I have to say, yes, we haven't paid for August yet. Excuse me, we haven't paid for October yet. Thank God we paid for August. We paid for September. We paid for October. We did pay for October. Now we're working on November. And it's getting later in November. Thank God. They're very patient here at the station. But we need you to step up. The Jewish Hour, every month we go through the same thing. We nickel and dime it till we get to pay the piper. And then, he says, you've got to pay to play. We pay to play, and we've been doing it for 20 years. And I have full faith in the Almighty that it's going to come through. And you're going to be the one to help. You're going to go to the computer, go to rabbifinman.com, click on the donations page, click a number. If you've got PayPal, it comes out of your PayPal account into my PayPal account. It takes 30 seconds. If you don't have PayPal, it takes 3 minutes. Don't like doing internet donations? Understood. There's a lot of really evil people out there that would even look to even think of stealing people's identities. I understand. So send your donation of any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. And I guarantee that blessings will be showered upon you and your family if you do. This, there's a rabbi by the name of Hirsch Brandwein of Stretten, who took over as the Rebbe of Aaron of Strelitz, who was a fall-off from Lubavitch in 1813. Aaron of Strelitz thought that he should be considered Rebbe after the Alter Rebbe passed away, so he started his own thing. His Hasidus is really high-flying, and there was a successor of people who took over for him with the name last name Brandwein. There was a famous klezmer person by the name of Naftali, or Naftuli Brandwein. I want to probably be part of this Sionic dynasty. So anyway, so he was traveling, this Hirsch Brandwein was traveling with a group of his Hasidim, and he came to a certain town, and he pulled up, he says, Esther Wagner, stop! And he's pulled up in front of a butcher shop. And there was a carcass hanging in the window, a front, as it's called, not a carcass, it's a front, a big old side of meat. So he went in and he asked the butcher, tell me about this piece of meat here. And he said, so-and-so the butcher, so-and-so the shoychet, the slaughterer who lives on this street, he's the one who did this meat. So he said, it may very well be that I'm going to want some of this meat. The Hasidim were very confused because the Rebbe really wasn't into food. And to eat meat like that, just like that. So they went to this house of this slaughterer who was not yet there. They waited for him. And he finally came in. And the rabbi asked the slaughterer, the shochet, let me see your knife. So he said, no. Now, Jewish law mandates that if a rabbi asks a slaughterer to show him his knife, he has to show him his knife because there's all kinds of problems that could develop that a person, it's his own knife, he could say, yeah, it's no big deal, that somebody else is going to say, no, this is a big deal. So he said, no, I'm not giving you the knife. So he told them, by the power of Torah, you must. So he said, okay. He gave him the knife. He checked the knife. It was perfect. And on the handle, it said, this knife belongs to Abraham ben Terach. There has only been in existence in the annals of history, Abraham ben Terach. So he looked at the handle where it said this, and he looked at the slaughterer, and he gave him like a wrinkled eyebrow, and the slaughterer shook his head yes, meaning yes, this was Abraham's knife that he used to prepare the meat for the guests and to slaughter the animals at the covenant between the pieces. And so he said, we're going to have your meat today. And he went and he got this big, whole big piece of meat, and they ate. There were some people that really didn't want to eat the meat. They just thought it was kind of strange, this whole thing. But then on the way out, he told them that this guy's knife belonged to Abraham. And they all felt really very bad about the fact that they didn't participate in such a wonderful repose. That's going to do it for us. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.